Before I begin, I want to thank Diane Fields, Liz Ross, for just helping, you know, through this process, getting this together today. So it's always a collaborative effort. So starting off with a quote, because I think it's appropriate. The movement has finally come of age. We had had enough of the state and the church telling us what to do with our bodies. And for the first time in Australia, a crowd of gay men and lesbians stood up to the police. The Stonewall riots may well have been a watershed for the worldwide gay and lesbian movement, but for Australia, the Mardi Gras of 1978 was our very first public act of resistance and a turning point in our struggle against oppression. This quote from Joseph Ciccardi, who's just here, so welcome him. One of the original 78ers, I think, sums up perfectly the impact of Sydney's gay and lesbian Mardi Gras, this first one. But I think that it was an extremely important turning point for LGBTI rights in Australia. I want to, in fact, argue strongly that there's no one single event that highlights more than Sydney's annual march parade and festival, the significant shift in mass consciousness and attitude towards LGBTI people in Australian society today. I know we often bemoan the political situation and wish it were better in this country, including those of us that feel the effects of homophobia, but it's been a real achievement just how far we've come to undermining and taking on a major oppression that exists and continues to exist and will always exist under capitalism. When you look at the situation confronting gays at that first Mardi Gras in 1978, and you see the situation today, you can start to appreciate just some of these gains of the LGBTI liberation movement. The first Mardi Gras, and thank you, Liz Ross, for organising this. The first Mardi Gras, in fact, as this lovely poster, the original poster for the original Mardi Gras, had three events. There were about 400 people that marched in the morning through central Sydney, followed by a public forum put on by the Gay Solidarity Group, and then in the evening there was 2,000 people that were involved in the parade. Well, look at today's numbers. The Mardi Gras that just happened, there was about 10,000 people in the actual parade. It was watched by hundreds of thousands of people, and it was put on television as well. That is a massive gap. And in terms of political mobilisations, there was 400 in the morning, okay. Today it's not directly linked to the Mardi Gras in terms of that festival or whatever, but political demonstrations about homophobia today attract across the country thousands of people, including 1,000 people and hundreds often in Perth, and in smaller cities like Adelaide and Brisbane in the hundreds. And I think that's a real achievement, and it shows just the statistical numbers from today compared to 78, how far we have come. I want to highlight by actually how far political movements come by reading the opening paragraphs from Melbourne University gay historian Graham Willett's book, Living Out Loud, A History of Gay and Lesbian Activism in Australia, because I think it really illustrates the point that I'm trying to make. And this is how he starts his book. It is not very long ago that the homosexual in Australia was to be feared, hated and persecuted. Lesbians and homosexual men were widely believed to be evil, psychologically disordered, or at the best, pathetically unhappy people. Religion called it a sin, psychology a mental illness. The law made male homosexual acts, even between consenting adults, illegal and prescribed harsh terms of imprisonment. Discrimination was actively pursued by state institutions, such as in the courts, schools and the public service. Newspapers in the 1950s and 60s, when they mentioned the subject at all, confined their coverage to transvestites and child molesters, soliciting public toilets and gruesome murders. The homosexual subculture, though growing, kept itself well away from the public gaze, and most homosexuals never came out except to others of their kind and perhaps a few chosen and sympathetic friends. The virus of hate inflicted even the homosexuals themselves. Many were, or believed, that they were, in fact, what society said. Mad, or bad, or sad. Others didn't self-hate, but they lived with the fear that if they revealed themselves, they would lose their family, their friends, and their jobs. I just think we have come so far, you know, and that is really, in the whole scheme of things, pretty recent. And I know for older people in the room, older LGBTI people in the room and friends, supporters, you, you know, probably can relate to some of what Graeme starts his book off as. We have come so far because of this liberation movement, a political movement from below. Now, what's that mean? That means ordinary folk standing up and taking on the establishment and their homophobic ideas that they, as an establishment, push through and on society. The political movement that enabled people to come out and be proud has fundamentally changed Australian society. The vast majority of people know at least one, but often numerous, LGBTI people in their lives. Coming out and being proud has normalised our sexuality to the great majority of people. Do not be mistaken. This greatly improved situation that we find ourselves today is no thanks to the government or an enlightened, educated few, but because of the struggles that you can see behind us on the streets, on our campuses and in the workplace. And we obviously feel the effects of homophobia today, the youth suicide rates, same-sex couples being banned from school formals, employment discrimination, Queensland still has age of consent laws that discriminate, general violence, just to name a few. But the general level of support from society has markedly changed for the better. In fact, it is clear which section of society still push homophobia, the capitalist establishment and their supporters. Julia Gillard is completely at odds with the large majority of people and basically everyone that voted for her, or at least preferenced her at some point at the last election, with her homophobic attitudes towards the same-sex marriage ban. When Channel 7 did a homophobic hatchet job on a New South Wales, outing a New South Wales government minister last year, they became the story for their bigotry. And remember, the government in question was extremely unpopular. When Ron Wilson, Channel 10 newsreader, labelled sections of this year's Mardi Gras as disgusting, he was forced to apologise the very next day. And not because he, you know, had changed his views, but because I think the public has changed their views and Channel 10 was facing a major backlash. When AFL footballer Jason Akermanis told gay footballers on the front cover of Melbourne's Herald Sun to get back in the closet, he was sacked. He was sacked, a decision made by his teammates. That is something that just shows, again, the significant shift in consciousness that I'm, you know, want to try and highlight between that first Mardi Gras that, and then the process happening then and today. So, it was a riot. Like, and we're going to, don't have to believe me, take me at my good word, we're going to have some video footage soon showing that. So, sing if you're glad to be gay, belted out of the lead truck's PA system as the street parade made its way down Oxford Street. Close to 2,000 people joined in, singing along and chanting. Out of the bars and into the streets, join us. 2, 4, 6, 8, gay is just as good as straight. At other demonstrations at that time as well, like earlier on in the morning, there were ones like, better blatant than latent. So there's all sorts of, we've got a lot to learn about, you know, chanting and stuff. I think that's somewhere we've gone backwards on. The first Mardi Gras was held on the night of June 24, the closest Saturday to the anniversary of the Stonewall riots, which occurred on the 28th. It was part of a weekend of international solidarity called by the San Francisco Gay Freedom Day Committee, who actually sent a letter to activists in Sydney. This is how Ken Davis, one of the key organisers, described events leading up to this first Mardi Gras in 1978. Just a bit of background for about Ken. He became a Trotskyist at the age of 15 in 1972 and came out at school in 1973. So he'd been quite a political person for quite a while before 1978. This is what how he described it. The receivers of this letter called together a small coalition of activists. Women and men from the Radical Sydney University Group, Active Defence of Homosexuals on Campus, from the Gay Task Force, and also from Marxist groups such as the Socialist Workers' Party, the Communist Party of Australia, International Socialists, and Spartacus League. Organising for International Gay Solidarity Day, the committee, which became known as the Gay Solidarity Group, was hopeful that the events would inspire more interest in gay political activism and enable it to mobilise people against the upcoming visit by British Morals campaigner Mary Whitehouse. Initially opting for a public forum, it later decided that on a Saturday morning march as well to encourage more people to attend. In addition, the Gay Task Force and CAMP, and Joseph told me a little bit about, you know, more detail around this and suggested a nighttime carnival that would move more slowly down Oxford Street. And that was also seen as trying to encourage some of the gays that were in the bars to actually come out on this day and get out onto the street. Through the 1970s, gay activism had been a feature of political life in Australia, but by the late 1970s, the movement internationally and in Australia feared a backlash. In the United States, and if people have seen the Harvey Milk film or documentary or both or one or the other, I really suggest that people do. In the United States, right-wingers have been campaigning to beat back a whole series of progressive law changes that had occurred because of the movement in that country. And in Australia, right-wing groups, including Fred Nile, had been organising anti-gay mobilisations. And as I mentioned before, chief homophobe from the United Kingdom, Mary Whitehouse, was going to be on her Festival of Light tour as well. Not to mention, despite previously promising law reform, numerous state Labor governments had reneged on that, apart from in South Australia. As I've said, people can see the original poster behind. But I also want to make a strong argument that, like, when looking through these events and that organising and so forth, it is a disproportionate amount of people that were involved in that were from the far left, you know. And I don't think that we want to... We want to be proud about that, but also make the political point for why would there be people, a disproportionate amount of people that actually have, you know, a world view that have been involved in a whole series of struggles throughout the 1970s, around apartheid South Africa, against the Vietnam War, appalled by the conditions that Aboriginal people found themselves in, and so forth, have been influenced by these other campaigns and issues and had learnt experience that actually when the call came out from San Francisco against the period of backdrop where there was a feared backlash against gays, that actually many of these, left-wing gays and members of these groups were actually the first people to really, you know, take on board and organise and, you know, the day of activity. And it's really interesting reading Peter Murphy, who actually was in the Communist Party, famously became well known because he got beaten up quite severely by the cops. When the cops attacked the march and so forth. It's really interesting reading some of his sort of activity and stuff, going to political meetings, fighting Tony Abbott. Tony Abbott at Sydney Uni used to organise going around bashing up the left, bashing up gays on campus. So just to give you a sense of this history, it's not, you know, and so forth. And it just gives you a sense that he says, well, I got political because I went to Alice Springs and I saw the condition of Aboriginal people. And then when Whitlam got sacked, this was just too much, you know. And so it's really important to say that it wasn't just gays, independent of politics, independent of a worldview, that actually helped push along and organise what became a significant event. And yes, they were critical, you know, of the parade, a lot of them, but they agreed to it and actually built it and also played a disproportionate role once the event unfolded in actually organising the demonstrations immediately afterwards, that night, the following day, and so forth. So the other great thing to assist me is that at this period, people have discovered video cameras and modern technology. And so you don't have to believe me and just watch these still photos. I'm going to now show some footage from Witches, Faggots, Dykes and Poofters, which was a film made in 1980. And the footage shows the riot, you know, the police attacking it, followed by the protests outside the court in Sydney. The solidarity protest that occurred a couple of weeks later, which up until then was the largest gay rights protest ever in Australia's history. And also a really great scene. It's this meeting of gay solidarity, and it's real fierce political debate, argument, trying to clarify and work things out, different politics clashing. And I think that that's really important, you know, that whenever there's an intensification in politics, you know, debate and argument is always part of that. And that's something that, you know, is, you know, to be welcomed. And I think it's a great sort of footage seeing this meeting happen. Thanks, JT.
...of International Gay Solidarity Day has since become an annual event.
That it was going to be fun after the march that we had in the morning. So I thought it was really important that we have a lot of people in.
Everything that the police told me, I relayed to the crowd over the public address system that was on the truck. But the police, in the way they talked to me, they were very hostile and obviously very angry about the fact that we were having a Mardi Gras down Oxford Street that night. And they also said that if we did stop along the route down Oxford Street, that the permit would be revoked and the Mardi Gras would be disbanded. In the van with the music on, that I was to continue driving the truck down Liverpool Street, which was away from where the people had gone. And I said, but our permit says we can go to the park, and I want to drive to the park with the public address system. And they said, if you drive this truck across to the park, we'll arrest you.
As we sort of turned back in our tracks from the El Alamein fountain, and I was reasonably at the front with a few other women, I didn't realise what was happening at the back. With a lot of the police apparently forcing the people back up Darlinghurst Street and more or less catching them in the middle of it. I was aware suddenly of a lot of police cars being in front of me, cutting off the street so that we just couldn't walk back to where we'd come from anyway. Anger when I suddenly heard all the police sirens come because the march had finished. I mean, we were disbanding, we were breaking up, we were just going to walk home, and the only way we could get home was up Darlinghurst Street. Admittedly, we were happy and we were singing songs and things like that, but I mean, you know, there was no thought that there was going to be violence involved in it.
They were determined to see that they could try to intimidate us in a way that we wouldn't want to march in the street again, and I think that sort of was a lead up to what happened later up at King's Cross when they came out in the violence and, you know, sort of openly bashing people, and they just want us to get off the streets and stay off the streets.
Thank you. very unfortunate that these sort of things happen. I think it's unfortunate that a couple of policemen had to receive hospital attention involved in the parade or the demonstration. I think what should be remembered is this, that those involved in the incident had had a pretty good go. They'd been given the freedom of the streets since early yesterday morning, and I don't suppose it's unexpected that the police would take exception to a busy thoroughfare at King's Cross being completely blocked off at midnight.
Most of the police I've noticed this afternoon and this evening haven't worn any numbers displaying, you know, who they are. They haven't named any charges at all. They refused to name bail. They refused to name people they've arrested. They refused right of entry to the police station so that inquiries can be made as to who has been arrested. They refused any democratic rights whatsoever. They refused people onto the footpath. They told people to move off the footpath to go on this other side of the street so that, because they were obstructing footpath traffic, allegedly. They didn't name the charge when the people were arrested, allegedly, for obstructing the traffic on the road. And the Motor Traffic Act says that the police should direct people that they are obstructing the traffic, and they refused to do that. They just arrested people and threw them in the paddy wagons. I saw people being dragged by their hair, punched in the face, dragged by their legs, dragged across the road. Just every single right that a person is entitled to in Australia has been blatantly denied by the police. And this station has just lived up to its reputation as far as I'm concerned.
Let them go! 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 Let them go!
Out of the 1,000 people, 53 had been arrested. In Darlinghurst Police Station, we received no blankets, no water, and no access to legal advice. It was 6 hours before 24 women who had been held in one cell were taken to Central Police Station.
And when we arrived at Darlinghurst, we were, I guess one of the women, I was shoved into a small room with 24 other women. And this cell was really designed for two people, and we had 24 of us. The space wasn't sufficient for us all to lie down together. There was one toilet in the middle of this cell that the 24 of us had to use, and we couldn't even get a drink of water, which we asked for repeatedly. And then we were just left for hours, and like nobody told us that we could make a phone call or anything like that, and when we asked for our rights, we were told what rights.
They never knew who arrested who or who did what, and they never even knew where they arrested a lot of people, because they were asking people, where were you arrested and all this sort of thing. And they even asked me, what do you think you've been charged with? Because they never knew what to charge people with. And, they just charged everyone with, I think, participation in unlawful possession. And people whom they didn't like or they knew before or something like that, they added extra little bits on, like resisting arrest or injury police or something like that.
When I got arrested, I didn't think twice about it. I thought I was being really unfairly treated. I hadn't done anything to deserve being arrested. I was just walking on the street with my friends. And the only sense that I could make out of that was that we were arrested because we were homosexual. I mean, that to me seemed to be the reason that the police didn't like seeing a lot of homosexuals together being happy, and they wanted to put us away for that, and that seemed to be our crime. From being like an outsider in society, a deviant, or what society sort of chooses to call us, that we didn't have any legal protection then, that we were outside of the law.
By about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I had a memo on my desk to see the headmistress urgently before I left to go home. So at 3:30 I went in there, and she sort of flashed this photograph in front of my face and said, "That's you, isn't it?" And I said, "Yes." I mean, it was obvious that it was me. And then she continued with the conversation, like asking what my sexual preferences were, which I tried to avoid answering and used a lot of jargon to get around not answering that question, because I knew immediately that I answered a question like that I would be fired, because it is an independent school. She asked me things like whether I had my name on any of the gay liberation newsletters or anything that they'd produced, and I sort of said no, because as far as I knew, I didn't. I mean, I might have it on camp and I might have it on lesbian feminists and other things like that, but obviously I don't have it on gay liberation. So what I was trying to do was avoid answering her questions. And she more or less went on and said things like, you know, heterosexuality is the way of relating to people and homosexuality is sick. And she really emphasised the sickness of the whole thing. I mean, the principal could not fire me on the fact that I just had a photograph in the paper with no name or anything like that. Legally, she couldn't do it. But the fact, I suppose, that worried me was that she was going to check up on me everywhere. And so for the next week, she was wandering around looking at my classes, checking out to see what I was doing with the children. But what it really says to me is the fact that there are so many gay teachers within schools that have to be quiet, that are not allowed to expose their lifestyle, and that can't be true to themselves, and what that does to one. I mean, I have felt totally oppressed within the last 2 or 3 weeks, you know, in being in the school.
2 days after the arrests of June the 24th, the charges were read in court. Again, there was violent confrontation with the police when they denied entry to witnesses and friends. Courts are usually open to the public until the magistrate asks for them to be closed. But that morning, gays were met with the unprecedented sight of police lining the court entrance. This was despite requests by the magistrate that the court remain open. In carrying out their illegal actions, the police arrested 7 more people. The arrests and the manner in which they were made raised several important questions, which were discussed at a meeting we held shortly after.
If I might talk about the permit that was issued and something about the law, we've heard a lot about the so-called Iniquitous Summary Offences Act. That's what Neville Rand called it in the last election campaign, the Iniquitous Summary Offences Act, that denies people the right to march except by a permit issued by the Commissioner of Police or one of his lackeys. What that means is that the law is exactly the same in New South Wales as it is in Queensland. The only difference is that it's administered slightly differently. Like in New South Wales, the police commissioner usually does give his permission to march. In Queensland, he does not. Also in that police permit, there was mention of there being no activities in Hyde Park. It's my view that that's completely outside any police power. It may well be within the power of the city council, but it's certainly something that the police commissioner can't forbid. The last time British subjects, and that's what we still all are, folks, the last time, I don't say that we ought to be, but we are. The last time people in our sort of legal heritage were shot for gathering together was in 1819. And I believe that ever since then, people in common law jurisdictions have had the right to gather together in public places for a concerted, lawful action.
I just want to say something about the root of it and also the thing about applying for permission. I think if we are going to march in the day, and I understand, you know, maybe people are scared to march at night, but I think at the very least we should go back to King's Cross, or at least in the Darlinghurst area, because it is partly because it was a march about homosexuality that people got beaten, but it was also partly because it was in the Darlinghurst police area and it was King's Cross. Now, King's Cross is a place where the police rule and violence rules. It's not just homosexuals who are beaten up. I've been beaten up there demonstrating about other things, rape, for instance. Now, what happened last Saturday night is people strayed outside those boundaries, did something the police didn't like, and they issue, even if they didn't issue their instruction, all they need to say is that they did, and then at the moment they feel they've got the power to move right in. And I think that's an important battle to fight back, to be able to walk in the streets again. And it's...
Do we want further discussion on this?
Someone was asking, we knew this, that the meeting be asked whether we want 2 speakers for and 2 speakers against before we make a decision.
I think it's interesting that we should split so briefly over such a classic political issue. Being a conservative at heart, as you all know, I think we ought to ask, I think it's important that Rand doesn't get another opportunity to slam us like he slammed us last Monday night.
We are setting ourselves up to be had by the ball, and I am not kidding about that. Those people are going to sit there and wait for us because they're saying, do here. Anything they like.
Graham's got a fucking by-election. All he's got is town. If you don't get any of the money that costs us,
possible, we're not going to get anywhere.
Can I say that it's now been voted by fucking heterosexuals that we're going to down on that?
My lady anarchist, please, heterosexual anarchist has made into a law and order issue.
Yes.
You do something to liberate yourself, or you're doing something that's supporting a police force and a fascist state. If you want to march, you march because you believe in something, and you don't ask whether you can do it if you believe it. So there's a situation that we don't ask because we have the right as human beings to march.
Listen, everyone's been talking about demonstrating outside the court. Now, if you believe that we ought to ask police permission, why the fuck go and demonstrate about people who were arrested for illegal marching? What's the point of it? If we're going to crawl to the coppers and say, please give us our rights, baby, and we're going to stick by what the coppers allow us, then why the fuck demonstrate? People who were picked up for illegal marching were legitimately arrested. If you believe that crap, if you think the police should have the right to pick you off the streets because you haven't obeyed their...
Permission was granted, and we marched on July the 15th as part of the Drop the Charges campaign. 3,000 people marched in solidarity, including representatives from the trade unions and the women's movement. At the time we marched, these questions were still to be answered. Why were Mardi Gras participants so violently arrested? Were the police acting autonomously or under instruction? Why were those arrested denied their legal rights, including access by lawyers and doctors? Who allowed the police to effectively close the courts? Did the Rand State government support this illegal action, or were the police once again acting autonomously?
Get your laws off my body, I want them out of my head. It's none of your fucking business what I do in bed. I'm gonna keep on singing and marching till you let me be. I don't wanna start no hassle, but I gotta be gay and free.
Cool. So yeah, I really hope that gives a sense to people around. It wasn't just smooth sailing, even after the cops obviously attacked it. And I think that meeting really gave a sense of the argument. But then the end result, like how inspiring is that huge demonstration at that time? And you can hear in the audio just the roar of the crowd chanting as well and sort of, you know, bouncing off the buildings. It really is, I just love that bit, that clip, and also shows... Yeah, the debate and argument, and thank God, yeah, as everyone cheered and clapped here, like, the right arguments got up. So let's conclude. So, like, campaigns against homophobia, like all struggles, are open battlegrounds for different political ideas. And, you know, although I've argued that the far left played a critical role in getting the first Mardi Gras, that day of events, to occur, it wasn't long before that that battle between the different political groups, the more conservative and reformist forces, the more political types within the gay community, and of course the gay business owners, and they've always done very well from making a small mint from our oppression. Started to influence the direction of the Mardi Gras. So after the third Mardi Gras in 1980, the debate about Mardi Gras, what it was about, the future direction, came to a head. There was a Mardi Gras task force that was set up, and the following questions were put to the community. And you can tell from the questions themselves, the direction, the move sharply to the right. If ever you've seen push polling, it's in these questions. So, I meant literally read the questions out that we put. The first question was, what is the goal of the Mardi Gras? And it was followed by, is it a political demonstration to demand gay rights, or is it a celebration of coming out, with its only political goals being to demonstrate the size and variety of the gay community and to establish its right to be? Two, should the Mardi Gras continue to be in Gay Pride Week, which, of course, remember, in Australia is in the middle of winter. It's the anniversary of the Stonewall riots. And then they say after this question, in the middle of winter, or should it be moved to summer when outdoor activities are more attractive? Three, if the Mardi Gras should move to summer, should it be around the traditional Mardi Gras time, February, March? Should we try and keep it exclusively gay, or should we welcome any groups who wish to join in? Four, should the Mardi Gras be run at a profit that could be used for a variety of activities? Five, if the Mardi Gras moves to summer, what then would happen to Gay Solidarity Week? Not much. We know, obviously, that the Mardi Gras did indeed, you know, move to summer and became less political in a number of ways. And, of course, well, I am, and we are, in social media, extremely critical, you know, of the direction that it moved. An event dominated by a far more conservative leadership who just endlessly sucked up to the establishment, both in government, tourism New South Wales, the police, various governments, local government, state government, and into the corporate world as well. You know, some of those fine corporate citizens like Telstra, Westfield, and, yeah, people that, corporations that, the worst. And, you know, they also not just wanted to run the event for profit, they obviously wanted to also highly police and regulate our struggle and to ensure that actually the very establishment that they were sucking up to, or for some of them actually became part of, you know, looking after their interests. And I think a low point had to be, a new low point for the Mardi Gras was in 1988, when in fact the New South Wales Police marched for the first time. And, you know, in more recent times as well, and if there's some Sydney comrades in the room, Kat Rose is actually the convener of Community Action, a co-convener of Community Action Against Homophobia, which is the key activist group, campaign group in Sydney today. In fact, they became a bit of a refuge at the 2010 Mardi Gras because a whole series of groups were deemed too political to be able to march. And so Carr actually said, well, come and march with us. But the trouble didn't stop there. Then they tried to regulate what placards Carr could have, you know, of course, you know, trying to censor, you know, all the left-wing content out. So there was a real battle that happened, let alone sort of a general sort of outrage that Mardi Gras wasn't really even taking up the message at all around marriage equality. But I want to argue that despite the best efforts of the Mardi Gras organisers to limit radicalism and disruption, politics and struggle have a habit of reimposing themselves, whether it's from the homophobic actions at the top of society or from below, like, you know, the campaign for marriage equality. So despite the endless sucking up, you know, to government and to the establishment and our oppressors, in the mid-1980s, actually, when there was a backlash, a severe one, you know, against the gay community because of HIV/AIDS, this actually did not put Mardi Gras in any stronger position. In fact, it very, very nearly didn't happen, you know, and that year, for the first time ever, sections of the media actually covered the Mardi Gras in some detail. And remember, by this stage, it was quite a large event, sort of tens of thousands of people would attend, including the fair and decent Sydney Morning Herald, of course, you know, respectable newspaper, actually had sensational and untrue stories about sex orgies and AIDS getting spread and so forth on the front of their newspaper. So just to give you a sense of the establishment and all its glory, even the bits of the establishment that tries to portray itself as something that it shouldn't be. So right through the history of the Mardi Gras, despite it being one of the largest annual events in Australia, and it literally has for a number of years since, really from 1986 onwards, has never been less than 100,000 spectators at this event. This is a very large event in this country. We have never seen prime ministers and opposition leaders, this includes the Labor ones, coming close to it. They avoid it like the plague, rarely making any public comments in office of support, and you can bet good money that whenever the Mardi Gras is on, the prime minister and political leaders will not be in Sydney. This, and it really just trying to highlight just the ongoing commitment to homophobia from the establishment, despite their understanding that public consciousness may have shifted across. And of course, you know, like you always see politicians at big events, hundreds of thousands of people, think football grand finals, whatever, they're always there, but you never see them go anywhere near the Mardi Gras. But then I also want to argue that it's the pressure from us that despite the best efforts of those that control the Mardi Gras, we in the left have always been involved in the struggles for LGBTI rights. You know, we've campaigned in our trade unions when the anti-capitalist movement emerged from Seattle in 1999 and spread around the world. You know, we were, organising in that. And we've never stopped organising and struggling and being part of the broader struggle for a better world because of the conservative approach of the Mardi Gras organisers. And we have, let's be blunt, the Mardi Gras, it's a huge event and so forth, but it's not the main game in this country anymore for pushing the struggle forward against homophobia. But the Mardi Gras can be pushed in a more political direction depending on the strengths of campaigns being waged. So despite so many LGBTI organisations not wanting to take on the establishment anymore, we have. And I think that we can be really proud, like I can see Kat Rose, the convener of Community Action Against Homophobia, Alison Hogg, the convener of Equal Love in Victoria, and actually a minor celebrity, really, in terms of her work in fighting for equal marriage rights and against homophobia. And there's numerous other people in this room who are just in a campaign. Jessica Payne is the main organiser in Brisbane around this campaign. And this campaign has actually resulted in having a strategy of mass mobilisations, involving as many people as possible, has made the same-sex marriage issue a more central political issue in Australian politics today. And those rallies have had a direct link to making it on, a bigger issue. And this pressure from below has flowed back directly onto the Mardi Gras. This year, Mardi Gras even had a petition around marriage equality in a survey and so forth, which is just such a far cry from the previous year. And we saw a record 17 floats dedicated to the issue of marriage equality at this year's Mardi Gras. And if people saw the way that the Mardi Gras was framed in the mainstream media, it was framed as being a political event about fighting for our rights, and you betcha, what one is it? About marriage equality. And I think that that shows, and this should inform us, that this, how the 17 floats, the way that Mardi Gras was portrayed in the wider media and so forth, our attitude, you know, towards this event overall, you know, obviously being highly critical, that one that actually, we need to support and is still part of, you know, the campaign in the broad sense, again, taking on homophobia. I think also we have to, our attitude in summing up is that the establishment doesn't like the Mardi Gras. You know, at the end of the day, the establishment doesn't support sexual liberation, does not support the ending of homophobia. Why would they? They preside over such an unfair and unequal society. The last thing they want is actually for people to feel free over their sexuality. And so I think that really is important, because their system can't allow it to happen. And so that's why the Mardi Gras is, you know, such an important symbol today for how far we've come to counter those kind of ideas. But we can't rest there, and I'll leave it at this point.